It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. When most people hear the word anarchism or imagine a society devoid of a centralized, top-down government structure, they probably think first of post-apocalyptic films like Mad Max or shows like The Walking Dead, where civil society has collapsed and life breaks down into a Darwinian struggle of all against all. In these Nietzschean fantasies, helpless people attempt to outrun a succession of warlords and gangs that seek to plunge them into authoritarian sadism. In fact, in films like The Dark Knight or shows like The Walking Dead, it's this need to crush the bad guy that we're told a state of exception is needed. Batman must gain access to a vast security apparatus, Rick Grimes declares this isn't a democracy, and all for the supposed benefit of saving us from what lies out there. It's this same spirit that would lead some to argue that it's precisely the function of the state to in fact keep the lights on, as Tucker Carlson most recently argued, to keep society from falling into the pit of ever-impending disaster and chaos. Yet ironically, in more and more instances, life in the US is marked by both disaster and the near total failure of state authority. In California, crumbling infrastructure and climate change leads to massive wildfires, blanketing the state in smoke and ash, and displacing millions from their homes. In Puerto Rico, decades of neoliberal austerity, colonial rule, and hurricanes fueled by global warming put millions in the dark as thousands die and the electrical grid and water systems collapse. Their response from the state is to hoard supplies that looters will later liberate. In cities like Flint, Michigan, and many native communities, people lack access to clean drinking water. And in Texas, a culmination of aging and depleted housing stock and a failing electrical grid leads to pipes bursting and millions being without power and drinking water following a devastating storm. And while popular culture paints the apocalypse as a reality marked by the absence of the state, ironically, all of these disasters are noted for their absence of government intervention. From Ted Cruz attempting to fly to Cancun, to mayors in Texas telling their constituents that only the strong will survive, and that asking for help is akin to socialism. It's important to note that the present era of disaster has seen widespread assistance, not from above, but from below, and ironically often from groups that argue society itself should be organized not along the lines of centralized bureaucratic state authority, but instead from the bottom up. Wanting to know more about how autonomous mutual aid groups have responded to the current crisis in Texas, in the midst of devastating storms which have left several dead, and millions without power and lack of access to drinkable water, we sat down with groups in Austin, Denton, Houston, and beyond to learn just how people respond when things collapse and people turn towards each other.
My name is Anna Maria. Anna Maria, if you can pronounce it that way. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I'm an organizer with Mutual Aid Houston.
Hi, I'm Kit O'Connell from Austin, Texas, he, him. I'm with a collective. I know this is a radio-friendly show. We're the Oh Shoot What Now Collective. You can substitute that S word for another S word. OSWN Collective, we're a small group here in Austin, Texas, but I worked loosely with a number of other people to, and groups to try to help them, such as Austin Mutual Aid and Austin Needs Water, and just other less organized mutual aid collectives that have sprung up all over Austin over this last few weeks.
I'm Sam from Denton. Cooperation Denton is who I'm with, and I use she, they pronouns.
Jason, they, them, also from Cooperation Denton.
I'm Scott from Stop the Sweeps Austin. I use he, him pronouns.
Hi, everyone. I'm Payaso. I use he, him pronouns. I'm in so-called Austin, occupied Lipan Apache, Tonkawa, Comanche lands, and I do work with Stop the Sweeps and Camp Support ATX.
So what's good, everyone? My name is Camilo. I'm with the Houston Tenants Union. Houston Tenants Union is an organization out of Houston, Texas, is committed to collective direct action, working class independence, and rank and file democracy. It was initiated by tenant organizers who were previously a part of the Southwest Defense Network, Third World Defense Network, 2100 Memorial Campaign, the GDC of the IWW, and various other housing and tenant labor movement work.
Much like the disasters in Flint, Michigan, and Puerto Rico, what happened in Texas didn't happen in a vacuum. CAPL's neoliberal policies meant housing stock wasn't prepared for the climate change-driven storm, nor was the electrical grid. This proved to be a recipe for disaster.
I think to understand how the conditions were magnified during and after the storm, it's useful to maybe briefly talk about the historical development of Houston. So Houston is like a truly neoliberal city. Unlike, for example, a city such as Chicago's, whose kind of main growth happened in the mid-20th century during the Keynesian era of capitalism. You know, it had a robust system of social services and public works that we've kind of seen decay over time. Now, Houston's biggest growth started in the 80s and really got underway in the 90s and into the 2000s. The social service and public work system never really grew as the city did, given the era that it really started to develop. What did exist in terms of social services and public works was quickly dismantled, and what's left is like a tiny fraction of what existed. And I can provide you with an example of this. So here locally, instead of investing in public housing, the capitalists in the city decided to construct super large apartment complexes in the 70s and 80s in various parts of the city for the growing working class. And Southwest Houston has many of these complexes and is where our actual campaign at Villa del Paseo is happening. And those complexes were built in the 70s. Now, these complexes, of course, are over 40 years old. They have tons of problems. They haven't been properly maintained. And they're constantly kind of being changed. They're being changed hands between different capitalists who make a few necessary repairs, but mainly cosmetics repairs, and then kind of flip them. And that's the case for like a lot of the infrastructure in the city. As a kid in the 90s, we used to have Houston Lighting and Power, HLMP. It was, state run and operated, and that was dismantled sometime in like maybe the late 90s or so. And that's when the Texas power grid kind of became privatized, right? And so the infrastructure there, because a lot of what happens here is like highly deregulated, there's not a lot of like oversight. Things aren't like properly weatherized. And so you have stuff happening to the infrastructure here, like gas pipelines, like freezing over. And, that led to kind of like this shortage in electricity and power when, people needed it the most during this ice storm and when we saw an actual peak, right? And still in Texas, like most of the power comes from natural gas and coal, right? Not a huge portion really comes from renewables like wind or solar.
And when the system did break down, as our guests explained, those that were most impacted were in poor and working class neighborhoods, often of color.
the wealth disparity in this city and the systemic inequality in this city is pretty bad even by U.S. standards. You know what I mean? It's so hard to talk about crisis in Houston because there's never not a crisis. Like, first of all, this is a city that is sort of relentlessly hit back to back with a climate change disaster. There are a couple of great articles that have come out even in the recent weeks about how like living in Houston is just one traumatic event after another. And so like housing inequality, food deserts, class disparity, like all of those things are what got magnified by the Great Freeze. So obviously we hit this point of like extreme catastrophe, especially like that first week. But at the end of the day, it's like, well, these are just exacerbated versions of the problems Houstonians face literally every single day.
In Austin, since 2019, Stop the Sweeps has been organizing to defend camps around town that are under threat of being swept by the city and formerly by the state, although they are in deep cooperation with each other. So since then, we've basically been trying to fight off these sort of de facto camping bans by the city crews coming in and messing up everybody's stuff and making everybody relocate. With COVID, a lot of that looked pretty different after we put a lot of pressure on the city. But it was actually a really familiar sort of, it was an eerily familiar moment as people living in houses weren't able to get services this last week, because that was the state that the camps were in when COVID hit. A lot of the people making sure that people were fed or had resources really disappeared in the moments, like right after COVID. And that's where Stop the Sweeps and Camp Support ATX started to provide food and other types of support to campsites that were left without resources.
I think a lot of the conditions that were really exacerbated by this last climate crisis were, you know, anti-Black state-sanctioned violence. A few days before the winter storm, Jordan Walton was murdered by APD. And then we saw, you know, the state abandon, you know, entire regions of so-called Austin that are traditionally Black and brown neighborhoods, and just kind of left people out to fend for themselves without electricity and water. Many people still have, you know, still don't have access to water right now. So that felt really important to name right now.
Yeah, now I would add too that the camps have been really struggling with water access, with a lot of businesses being restricted, especially in the early days. And there's some light city infrastructure that's getting people water out there, but a lot of that sits like unmaintained and unrepaired. Also, just to add to that, the folks living outside in the camps are disproportionately Black, Indigenous, and Brown folks. So that's like hitting them hard as well. And the city was like really comfortable just letting the sort of regular cold weather shelter program sort of be what they were offering, where you go in from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. and then you're kicked back out. They were just going to go ahead with that, like even though we were hitting like temperatures like in like the single digits, until we started putting pressure on them early on.
And Denton, it's like any city. You know, we have areas of people that have the, you know, excess riches, and then, you know, poorer neighborhoods, which. And Denton, in Southeast Denton, it's predominantly Black. And, you know, a lot of the things that were, you know, exacerbated when the storm hit were things that were already there. You know, I think as we all know, you know, usually neighborhoods of color, you know, they, they get the worst of it, you know, as far as their water goes, as far as keeping electricity on, even in the best of times. So, you know, when it hit, it just created a complete disaster.
One thing I wanted to add about Austin, we're in this weird political situation where supposedly there's no camping ban, but as my comrades explained, there's been these sweeps anyway, where they come in and take people's belongings. Stop the Sweeps and the Camp Support Group have done amazing work in a very hostile climate. That camping, removing the camping ban, seems like it's obviously helped people, but it also has exposed people without homes to just incredible amounts of hostility in our city that Stop the Sweeps and their allies have been working to oppose. We're in this very weird situation right now, as I said, where we just elected this city council member who was a former Gamergate supporter and also is aligned with a pro-cop fascist biker gang. And what she's done is provide cover for the sort of centrist members of the city council to push to the right, which means that the work that people supporting those without homes have been doing has gotten even more challenging. Plus, there's potential that the state itself may interfere more with what the city is doing to supposedly help people without homes. So it could get even worse pretty rapidly. And that was all kind of in place before the storm.
Once the storm hit, the state's electrical grid failed, leaving more than 4 million Texans without electricity or heat. The lack of power also affected water treatment plants, and soon people were being told to boil their water, despite the fact that many people couldn't use their electrical stoves to do so. While power returned in a few days, over 7 million people remained on a boil water notice. Many folks weren't prepared for such cold weather. So far, the news is reporting over 80 deaths, with the exact toll feared to be much higher. These include people that ran their cars in their garages in an attempt to stay warm, only to die of carbon monoxide poisoning. An 11-year-old boy who was found frozen to death in his own bed. A grandmother and three grandchildren who died in a fire that was started in an attempt to stay warm. There are other stories, people that couldn't get medical treatment due to lack of water, elderly folks who couldn't stay warm enough, people attempting to brave the elements outside, only to fall through the ice. According to the Wall Street Journal, Travis County, which includes Austin, is currently processing more than 80 cases to determine the cause of death.
So I think that's something, especially folks that perhaps don't live in the South, are having trouble understanding, is that this was largely an unprecedented event, right? So it's like we all knew intellectually that, oh, big bad storm is coming. As a group of people who have weathered multiple hurricanes, I think we all sort of collectively thought we understood what this would look like. But we didn't. So when the storms hit, as a city, we were woefully unprepared. And that is true on the individual level, but in a much more real sense on the infrastructural level and on the electoral level. Like, the storm hit and we realized that we had no experience to draw from when dealing with this. Like, even so for example, when a hurricane hits, right, we got people on boats. We can be like, all right, let's pile a bunch of people on boats, let's go rescue people. When the roads iced over and people's pipes started bursting and people started freezing and people couldn't go get food and people couldn't go get water and they didn't have water, like when all of these dangers set in simultaneously and very suddenly, because I think it was like a beautiful warm day, and then it devolved into the freeze. So when all of these things happened at once, the crucial thing was that there was nowhere to go, and that there was no one who could really help anybody else, because everybody was trapped in their respective little areas of frozen over hell. And so everybody just kind of lost power, lost signal, so lost access to each other, couldn't drive, could barely walk because of how frozen everything was, how cold it was. So just everything was stripped away overnight, very quickly, and there was no infrastructure in place to render aid. So people just woke up and found themselves in extreme life-threatening danger.
Right away, like what, you know, I and some of my neighbors experienced, as well as other people in the larger Denton community, like there's no power. It's getting cold. It was getting, you know, it got down to like 40 degrees in my apartment. I've heard of, you know, some places getting colder. I've heard of some people kind of going to drastic measures just to stay warm, like, you know, hanging out in their garage, in their car, turning on the heater, cooking, or like boiling water and turning on the oven when they did have power. It seemed like the power was like out and on, you know, at different times, different parts of town. I've heard of like even, you know, the more suburban, little wealthier side of town, like the power like went out maybe once a day there for like an hour. And over here, you know, we were having to like kind of make schedules where like it seemed like 1 hour the power would be on, next hour it'd be off, and it was just back and forth. So there was a lot of like kind of scheduling how you were going to like do things, like cooking food or charging your phone, even having like cell phone reception. Like I wasn't able to call anyone or really talk. So that really, you know, made organizing difficult, checking in with family difficult. When, you know, we would try to go get food for people, there were instances where like we'd be in the grocery store and like the power would go out and they'd like start telling us to leave their stores like completely empty.
Yeah, during the first days of the freeze here, which actually weren't so dramatic until really, I remember Sunday seemed to be the most intense day. It was already freezing Wednesday or Thursday night. And we had organizers going around town to camps that we'd been building relationships with for a long time and checking in and seeing if anybody wanted a hotel room. And at that time, we didn't know where the money was coming from. So people were just sort of putting whatever they could on credit cards to like get people in. People were going and visiting the shelter downtown nightly to try to connect with people and get people gear or bring people into hotels if they were able to. But yeah, as it sort of set in, you know, we have these like, we're doing visits at the shelter, and you know, there's photos of people out waiting outside of the shelter in like covered in snow. As stuff came through, that used to be the spot where people were sent to get to cold weather shelter. Back, you know, like before COVID, and in the several days, the location that people would go to in order to get into city run cold weather shelter changed several times. So, it seems like some people were out there waiting for a ride that never came. Yeah, and it got colder, and then by Saturday night, the roads were getting a lot icier, and volunteers were driving through even like worse and worse conditions to try to get to people and bring people in. We were putting out call-ins starting, I believe, that Thursday to try to get the city to open up. It's cold weather shelter for 24 hours a day and on like a walk-in basis, because the way that it was set up, you'd have to get all the way across town and then hop a bus to like go to a community center on somewhere on a different side of town where it may not even be near where your community is or where your camp is. So we were advocating that they open those 24 hours on like a walk-in basis when they were still only offering them like on an overnight basis with this busing option. And then we were pressuring them to issue money for hotels so that people could just go to a hotel near them and just get shelter wherever they could without having to sort of like wring themselves through this bureaucracy. So But it was really eerie. Somebody mentioned, a reporter that was paying attention to our call-ins mentioned that we were the first people that were bringing up the need for 24-hour cold weather shelter access. And he was looking back at some tweets that he put out later in the week, like on Tuesday or Wednesday, and was like, where would we be if we didn't have like this 24-hour like shelter access, as like the infrastructure started to go down for more and more people in Austin? But they were just willing to just play it like normal, and they weren't even thinking about they weren't thinking ahead as the storm rolled in.
People down here, I think, even, you know, it's important for people outside of the South to just remember how poorly equipped people are down here, even if they do have a home. You know, our homes are less insulated. Our heaters are less capable of handling this weather. And there really wasn't, for most people, I think, you know, any awareness of how bad things might get. And I know, hearing from people in camp support, that certainly people in camps had no idea that this incredibly severe storm was coming in. And I think the same held true for, you know, even people in homes didn't realize that there were going to be these power outages. And of course, in Austin, the so-called rolling blackouts for many, many people in town ended up lasting 40 hours or more, just going on and on. And there was no rolling. Sometimes people might get power back for an hour, but in general, they were just out. And of course, once that happened, all the uninsulated pipes in the apartment complexes started to burst. And I walked around my apartment complex during one of the worst days of the freeze, and there was just water pouring out of all different buildings. And in some cases, people in Austin still don't have their water back because their apartment complexes were so poorly equipped to handle this.
We weren't prepared for it, you know, with our infrastructure, you know, with the supply line shut down and everything like that. And, you know, mentally as well, and communally, we weren't prepared as a community. Everybody did a really great job coming out and kind of helping each other. But, you know, there's this real individualist kind of ideal going on in Texas sometimes, where it's like, you know, I take care of my own type of thing. And, you know, that definitely interrupted, you know, our day-to-day lives. And, you know, like Sam was saying, with, you know, people in their cars and their garage, you know, some people didn't think, you know, maybe I need to crack my garage, but my car, you know, we did have some people succumb to carbon monoxide poisoning. But it's hard to think, you know, when the inside of your house, you know, is 38 degrees, 37 degrees, you're trying to figure out, you know, what to do with your kids, how to keep your kids safe from hypothermia. And you know, that's just even worse when you look at poor neighborhoods, and then, of course, you look at our houseless neighbors. You know, it becomes like, it's a nightmare, and it was a nightmare. So it's just, you know, we weren't prepared, and that definitely affected our day-to-day lives. You know, things changed, and I think that some of the outlooks have definitely changed afterwards.
You know, I think, like, something that also really affected me and my community was, you know, something that Kit kind of mentioned about how apartment complexes weren't prepared to deal with a disaster either, and that type of climate. You know, in my apartment complex, and not only the roads, but the entire sidewalks were iced over. And so if you think about, you know, the spectrum of people that are disabled, you know, how, you know, this world is already so inaccessible, and how much our infrastructure really affected people's accessibility and like their access to their basic needs, you know. And in my neighborhood, the grocery store was closed for days. So, you know, we couldn't get anywhere to buy food. Like, it really felt like even just that basic need of getting supplies to eat was impossible. Much less to even leave the apartment complex, because where I live, there's only one entrance and exit of the apartment complex, and it's this really big, like, downhill road that leads right into I-35 frontage. And so you know, one day I spent like the whole day just trying to help cars get into the apartment complex because they kept getting stuck. And so even just getting home and leaving felt almost impossible, much less like adding the fact that entire grocery stores, even 7-Elevens, you know, for the folks that know what 7-Elevens are, like, were closed. So, you know, yeah, it was just really hard. It was complete like survival mode on top of just like being in survival mode of living in a racialized capitalist settler colonial society.
I mean, I'm sure anyone who's been through any kind of like crisis, they can relate to going to supermarkets and just have everything being like bare, right? There were shortage of food, water, fuel, propane and other natural gases that people use to run their heat with because of the high demand, but also because the roads were in such bad conditions due to the ice and whatnot that it really prevented new shipments from arriving quickly to restock shelves. So people were, you know, desperate to get whatever supplies they could and were, you know, relying on neighbors, etc., to try to find these things. Also, the news was just like flooded with all kinds of horror stories and like heartbreaking stories of people dying of carbon monoxide poisonings because they're trying to heat their homes in all these dangerous ways by pulling in their barbecue pits, using their gas stoves to heat things, and then maybe the pilot going out and then they're just like, you know, breathing in carbon monoxide. So there were, you know, carbon monoxide deaths, stories of like people freezing to death in their homes. There was a really heartbreaking one out of a little town north of Houston called, it was either Conroe, I think it was Conroe, of a young boy freezing to death in his home and his family not realizing until they all woke up the next day he had passed away in his sleep. So just heartbreaking stuff like that, man, you know, people trying to do whatever necessary to keep their families warm and then, you know, paying the price for that.
In the midst of all this, organizers slowly began to connect with each other and mutual aid projects began to take shape.
It was a weird combination of all of those things. Like the shift from isolation to mobilization was very spotty and sporadic because it would be like, oh, I suddenly got signal for 30 minutes. Let me try to touch base with people. Let me try to connect with people. So it was like, it was just individuals, not even organizations, just individuals getting flashes of connectivity. And immediately touching base and reaching out and going online and being like, hey, do y'all know anybody who needs food? Like, I've got, I think I can figure out how to drive 10 miles per hour down this icy road and deliver a couple caskets of water to folks. Do you know anybody in need? Or does anybody have this? Does anybody have a heater? Does anybody have blankets? Does anybody? So it really started out mid blackout. With us not having power or water, reaching out as individuals, just to sort of see if we can do anything at all, because that was really the worst part of those initial few days, was that feeling of helplessness, of knowing what the need is food, the need is water, the need is warmth, and the complete inability to render that aid. That was honestly very traumatic. In those early days. And especially like, so for mutual aid, like we have over the last year hammered out a really great system of like redistributing wealth. And this is one of those situations where it's like straight up people need food right now. So like once I started connecting to internet, I was seeing donations like pour in from across the country, which was so dope. But I was like, I am trapped in my house. Other people are trapped in their houses. And then as the hours passed and more people started braving the streets, then the grocery stores started running out of supplies. So these individual efforts that slowly started to coalesce into individual organizers and community members linking up and trying to work out supply drop-off systems, then those started to be limited because actual retailers started running out of food and water. But the mobilization did happen, you know, and especially after 2 days had passed, after 3 days had passed, more and more of us started connecting. I think by like day four or five, all the mutual aid organizers were finally able to hop on a Zoom call and touch base and be like, okay, this is what we've been able to sort of haphazardly throw together over the last few days. Now let's meet, let's take a breath, let's figure out what we're going to do as a mutual aid organization from here. And then we pivoted to figuring out how to handle this influx of financial solidarity that we'd received from around the world at that point. But before that, it was a lot of like me and a few other women in a group chat being like, okay, I heard that this family in Northeast Houston is in need of water. Let's find drivers. I made a group me and I was like, hey, folks, if y'all have winter tires or are comfortable driving around a little bit near your house, join this group me. And so it was just a lot of like staying up till the wee hours of the morning, coordinating with strangers and doing what we could.
For Cooperation Denton, you know, we're not traditional mutual aid network. We're a communal, pretty much a group in the Bookchin vein. So for us, you know, it's just, you know, we saw it was coming in the Sunday before. You know, some of us had been kind of watching what was going on. And, you know, things were still kind of up in the air, you know, how bad it was going to get. And so Wednesday afternoon, we put out a tweet to some of our other comrades in the area, you know, asking if they needed any type of support, you know, if they had anything going on, we could jump on board if we didn't want to supersede any type of organizing they'd already done to prepare for it. Well, we didn't get anything back, really, other than, you know, some things about, you know, what Denton was planning on doing, which wasn't much. We went ahead and decided to open up a GoFundMe to try to get people to help donate so that we could start putting people up, you know, our houseless neighbors into motels and stuff like that and giving them food. I'd like to say that it was like, you know, this big organized effort, but it was kind of ad hoc. There was eight of us to start with for like the first 4 days. Between picking people up, getting where they needed to be, calling hotels, figuring out what the availability was, talking to various nonprofits around the area, you know, in shelters as far as if they had people that they needed us to take care of that they couldn't. And, you know, we just kind of went from there on it, you know, they're driven by, you know, empathy and just the know that that something had to be done, that, you know, we just couldn't, there's no way you could let people, sleep out in that type of weather. They shouldn't be sleeping in any of the cold weather, but there's no way in hell that you can let them sleep in, you know, at night. It was getting down, you know, surely like Sunday going into Monday, I think it was like -10 or something like that. And this, you just can't do that. You can't let that to happen. Regardless of what the city or the state is planning on doing, we didn't worry about deferring to the state or the city because they were there. You know, they wanted to open up warming centers for, you know, during the day, and that wasn't adequate.
And to kind of add on, you know, what Jason said, So once we kind of got that started, it the first couple of days, I mean, there was only like eight or so of us kind of, you know, taking calls, driving people, picking people up, booking hotels, making food or making meal arrangements. And I think, you know, us kind of promoting to, you know, some of not only our other comrades in the area, social media really helped us get more volunteers and people that wanted to help. So that really helped. The way we kind of operated like changed like several times within that week. Essentially what we were doing is like our, you know, we had this dispatch line that anyone who needed housing, welfare check, grocery, anything, would call, and we would kind of organize and mobilize people based off of like who was available for what. And, you know, so we had several things going on. We had, you know, people solely driving and checking on people who refused to come into shelters or who refused to go into a hotel. So, you know, some people were out going and just checking on them, making sure they're okay, taking out extra supplies, food. Some people that were solely preparing meals for everyone that we had. There were a couple of situations, you know, that we kind of did have to de-escalate and really provide some mental health, mental support. So we were kind of doing a little bit of everything. I noticed too, like, even people that, you know, maybe aren't left-leaning or know much about communalism were just coming because they saw there was this need. So they just wanted to show up for their community. And I think that was really, really helpful because we wouldn't have been able to do it alone with just so few of us.
It really helped us in Austin with Stop the Sweeps and Camp Support ATX that we had built out a lot of infrastructure that was fairly decentralized before the storm, starting in at least April, March of last year with the shutdown. What happened there was, when everything sort of like dried up, when all the food services and, you know, places where people would go to get like, help like accessing like stimulus checks, like when a lot of those things like withdrew, we were like, all right, there's this, like, we were very acutely aware that hunger was like growing in the camps. But then we were also like trying our best to be as like COVID responsive as possible. So where prior to that moment, a lot of our organizing had been sort of like going from camp to camp, usually, you know, up to 15 over the course of a day, following sweeps or sometimes like visiting before sweeps to help organize people or afterwards to like check in. But a lot of it was sort of like in motion, like going from one camp to the next. So we made the call to ask people in our network, to adopt camps or to work on building out like relationships with specific, areas in town. And encourage people to really go deep with those connections and those relationships and have them be fluid as well. So it's not just like us like showing up and being like, oh, we have this stuff, but like really like going and like listening to like what the needs are and what people's experiences are and having folks in camps like participate as much as possible in that organizing. And then also like raising demands too, based on what those things are, to show how they were being left behind by the city and the state and the NGOs especially. And so we went into the freeze with this like pretty, decentralized network sort of already in place with like people that had, like deep sort of like geographic connections to different areas. And that really like, I think allowed us to really scale and to really offer as much as we could to what ended up being, you know, hundreds of people, like just in the hotels, not to mention the hundreds more that didn't want to go in, or at least maybe didn't want to go in immediately, you know, to like keep checking in on people, and to like make sure that like, oh, if you want to let somebody that's more vulnerable like go first, like we'll definitely be back like the next day to like check on you and see if like you want in, you know. So I would say in that way our decentralization was a strength going into it, and a bunch of different groups and people and little crews supporting specific camps and medic collectives really kind of all just sort of started playing these like really crucial parts. And though things sort of got a little bit more centralized, especially as like funding started being directed towards like specific like really large GoFundMes. Like going into it, a lot of it was based on having lots of people going really deep with like lots of different relationships.
I think a lot of these networks that we've built out, these like decentralized autonomous networks, really, really like made it possible and strengthened us in a lot of ways, because, you know, like a lot of the people that were helping out these houseless folks already knew these people. You know, it wasn't just like a strange face showing up to a camp. It was, you know, people that have been creating these networks of care and mutual aid for, you know, about a year. And I think like also just beyond that. And I think that that really facilitated our work. And also just like the centralization of funds going to specific groups, I think hindered that work, but also I think we saw the resiliency of our, you know, networks really, really like show themselves.
Because our infrastructure was so poor, as we've touched on already, as the freeze was at its worst, it was very challenging to perform mutual aid tasks during some points, because even people who had 4x4 or front wheel drive, you know, or all wheel drive vehicles were not able to navigate on the roads. We don't have plows. There's not like routine salting. So there was a moment where, for people who could get onto social media, we were seeing these kind of cries for help that were very hard to answer. But, I think what has been touched on already that is so important is the more organized people were already, the faster they were able to come online. Another group I'd like to highlight is, sort of an ad hoc group that formed out of local Burning Man participants in Austin that have been helping a lot. Some of those people were involved with street medic support during the Black Lives Matter protests over the summer. Obviously, Burning Man has issues with accessibility, but locally, that culture does have an intense volunteerism aspect, and they were able to use that infrastructure to come online very quickly to help people start delivering water to people. As soon as the roads were accessible, start bringing supplies and survival hygiene stuff to people. Another thing that's really interesting that you wouldn't normally necessarily think of as a source of mutual aid, but here, Buy Nothing Facebook groups became a major source of survival. And those are already organized by neighborhood. So it helped, especially during some of the worst parts of the freeze when it was hard to travel. People were getting on their Buy Nothing group instead of saying, hey, I have an extra bread machine. It was like, hey, I need distilled water or I'm going to die. Can you help me out? And people were able to help out in those neighborhood groups. And I think that really shows the power of like neighborhood organizing and the potentials for meeting people where they are. So that's not something I normally think of as mutual aid, but it was a vital source of support.
Many of those getting involved in organizing mutual aid responses were not acting in a vacuum. Autonomous groups had mobilized in the wake of Hurricane Harvey, helping to provide food, water, and aid to those impacted by the storms, and also working to repair homes in working-class areas. After the coronavirus hit, mutual aid groups activated and began to organize in impacted communities. These networks and projects would go on to inform the initiatives that sprung up in the face of the deep freeze.
You know, that continuity is a huge factor in struggle whenever you have organizations that remain active even after crisis moments. They're, what they can do, what they're able to pull off really shoots up in these times, right? Like, you know, they're just able to kind of mobilize a lot faster. They already have connections to one another. They're easier to find resources and tap into existing, you know, networks. So I think they played a huge factor, and they were able to really like respond quickly to things once people got up and moving again.
But while mutual aid projects were beginning to get off the ground, the state itself was largely absent.
It was cricket from the state. It was like, hey y'all, things are bad. Stay inside. Stay warm. And it's like, excuse me? Thanks for the directive, elected officials. And then, you know, they started issuing out boil notices. It's like, hey, y'all, don't drink the water. Boil the water before you drink it. And it's like, people have electric stoves. How are they supposed to boil water with no electricity? It was just like a lot of decentralized PSAs and belated information being disseminated, missing several crucial swathes of the Houston population, I may add, because not everyone, even before the storm, had online access. But yeah, I mean, the state was absolutely useless. The structures that are supposedly, that it supposedly exist to help us did nothing. They did nothing preventatively. They did nothing during the storm. If anything, like, I want to say HPD was like, in these times of crisis, crime goes up. So we're going to be out there patrolling through. I'm like, what are you talking about? People are dying. Absolutely no help from the state, which is astonishing to me because, like, I know hospitals were out of water, like actual hospital staffers freaking and having meltdowns and now have PTSD because they had to just watch people die for no reason. Like, we're out here begging on Twitter for if any of our famous followers are able to get a copter out to Houston with food and water. And meanwhile, our politicians are doing nothing or going on international vacations or just simply doing nothing. I'm not gonna lie to you, those like first 5 days, a blur. But I do believe I remember seeing like a post from HPD being like absolutely just cracking down on crime in the middle of a climate catastrophe when people were dying, instead of, I don't know, figuring out how to render aid. Like, they were focusing on arrests rather than food and water.
You know, the question of, you know, what did the state do or where did they fail? You know, I think that's why we're all on here. We realize the state does fail on a regular basis. If a bunch of people and mutual aid groups realize, you know, 3 or 4 days beforehand that this is a major problem fixing to happen, but our elected officials either got their heads in the sand or for whatever reason, you know, they're either completely, you know, inadequate as officials, or they just don't care. It's one or the other. And the state did fail on, you know, at every level, from our very hyper local levels, so, you know, of cities and stuff like that, up to the entire state itself. Even the nonprofits, like we would call nonprofits and stuff like that and ask them, you know, do you have people that you can't, that you need us to take care of, that you need to push off to us? Because, you know, I realize, you know, same with the shelters, with the COVID situation and, you know, trying to keep it to where, you know, you can't operate. A lot of our shelters couldn't operate at max capacity because of, you know, COVID. And, you know, the regular response from the nonprofits was, well, we're happy that you guys are doing this, but how much money you got and can you give it to us? Is pretty much what it boiled down to. And, you know, the nonprofits are propped up by the city. They're propped up by the state. And, you know, as we've seen through disasters throughout the years, whether it's hurricanes or flooding and stuff like that, you know, half the time that you give money to places, you know, nonprofits, it's not actually going to the people that need it. It's going into the pocketbooks, you know, into building a new building or, you know, this higher up needs more monies. And they did. They objectively failed completely.
So I was on dispatch. I was, you know, taking a lot of the initial calls. And at one point there was a caseworker from a government-funded organization asking if we could provide assistance and shelter to this person because they didn't have enough funds to provide that for them. So I was really taken back, but also not surprised, by that. And, you know, other times when I was out driving and picking people up, there was, you know, a couple of different points where we were straight up being picked up, like, or picking people up from some of the homeless shelters, pregnant people even that were being told that there's not enough space and they need to go find somewhere else. It was multiple people telling us that. So we would show up and pick some people up and go book hotels.
In Austin, the cops were like arresting people like into the freeze. You know, they were like driving by the folks like sleeping outside of the Arch, the homeless shelter downtown, and were still arresting people like off of the curb. So that was one level. On an official level, when we were booking hotels, we started to hear that there were nonprofits and city people that were working on this project too. And, oh, they had it. And, oh, they had a deal where they had access to 2,000 rooms and, at like $70 a night. And they negotiated this with this hotel association and they were raising money for this. But it turned out that the city, even though the city like has like the ability to open hotels, and get fully reimbursed like 100% by the federal government, like during COVID, like there's like funds for them to do this. And there's also been some people in Denver who are like advocating for the state and the city to just seize hotels and move people in, during COVID. So there's a bunch of different strategies where there's not even like a penny out of the city's pocket to open shelter for people. The city worked with this nonprofit to like guarantee these rooms, which never ended up like showing up to my knowledge. And then they put up a GoFundMe through a nonprofit that was collaborating with several city council members. And then the city council members donated like up to like $100 to $500 to that GoFundMe, which was the extent of their official response getting people inside the hotels. So that just really like spoke to me as this just like really cruel like kind of co-optation of this moment that we keep finding ourselves in so many ways, where our survival is based on GoFundMes and our survival is based on who can hustle the most like in a crisis, who's this economy of like who's more deserving to get their insulin funded or whatever, that like the city was doing that to fund an official strategy was just like totally obscene. So that was one story. And I think it's important to like, for us, at least, you know, we try to make demands to polarize people around city officials in a city that's like, that tells the world it's a very progressive place and where people regularly get into fights with the Republican governor and lay like a lot of stuff like on his feet. It seemed like as soon as the like electrical infrastructure failed, that like the city was just like so in this like awful way, like kind of grateful to sort of like unload the burden of this crisis like onto state Republican leadership, where they themselves had just been ignoring people living outside and ignoring organizing crews that were demanding access to buildings for people to sleep and stay out of the freezing weather.
Hotels were telling you sometimes that no, they won't take homeless people, or even charging you more as time went on. We saw a lot of that where it started off as at, you know, like $60 a night, and before you know it, it was like, no, it's like 110, 120, 130.
We had that too in Dallas. We had some participants that were sheltered off of I-30 and Dolphin in the area over there in East Dallas. And at first they didn't, the owners didn't really want to cooperate with us. And then once they saw that the checks cashed, you know what I'm saying, baby? Then they wanted to respect our participants. You know what I'm saying?
You know, I have a comrade who has been chronically houseless for 17 years and has been doing like a lot of mutual aid work and experienced a lot of discrimination on behalf of hotels, even when other people who were very easily at that time, you know, having access to hotel rooms and getting like, you know, $60, $70 nights. This person was just getting like, and the people that were trying to shelter at the time were getting declined. So yeah, like just all the hotels, the city, nonprofits, you know, really like nobody showed up. None of them showed up. And it was really just anarchists and other leftist folks who were doing the hard work to, you know, help folks.
A friend from the Challenger Street newspaper, I heard from him that he was in a hotel. He'd gone on his own to book a hotel, and they were increasing it night after night. And after 3 days, he just couldn't like take the increases anymore. So he and his friend checked themselves out and walked like, I think like 10 miles through the snow, and the ice to get to the city warming center. So yeah, that was happening with people that were not part of these like big blocks of folks that were moving in. Whole hotels were getting like evicted, like during the middle of it. We're also struggling to like keep people like in hotels as long as they would like, and trying to pressure the hotels and the hotel associations and the city to come and like step up and like front the cost of that so that like individuals and mutual aid groups can focus their attention elsewhere. And like, yeah, it's been just like, oh, sorry, we won't let you renew this reservation like after this date. Even though there's nobody, like I was told by a hotel representative that they really wanted to work with us, that it's great, that, you know, they're not in a position to like front the money because like basically only people wanted hotels like during the crisis and like before and after, like they're back to being empty. But it's like y'all had enough money to be turning people down who wanted to re-rent those rooms. You know, like you had enough money to say no, even when there's literally nobody else renting for you guys. So that continues. A lot of volunteers had to front their IDs, because that's just like a basic barrier to getting into hotel rooms is IDs or credit cards or stuff that a lot of folks don't have or have had like stolen or lost by police. Yeah, we saw a lot of that.
They will withdraw over double the amount of what the rooms are just out of like withholding it in just for insurance purposes or whatever they claim.
I just want to say we saw that in Cooperation Denton as well. Most of our people had to provide ID as well. And then we'd see things like where they told us one charge and then it's like, well, what's all this extra for? And, you know, of course, the response was, you know, in insurance reasons, you know, we got to make sure, you know, our houseless neighbors don't go crazy and tear up a room. And it's like, well, we already know how you feel about these people. I mean, you're showing it. I'm trying to watch that cussing thing. That's messed up. It's real messed up.
Suburbs of Houston and wealthy areas within Houston were getting power like a day or two into the storm. And if not full power, they were getting sort of rationed power. Like there were rolling shifts where it's like, okay, this neighborhood's going to have power for an hour. And then this neighborhood's going to have power for an hour. And then, and so they were part of this shift system. Meanwhile, there are still poor neighborhoods in Houston. Almost, what is it, 2 weeks now? They still don't have water. Yeah. It's quite plain. They will always prioritize rich neighborhoods, which are predominantly white neighborhoods. Always have, always will.
As the days wore on, mutual aid programs began to come together as groups worked to distribute clean water, food, supplies, and also put people in hotels that would take them. Organizations like Stop the Sweeps in Austin, who had already been fighting the eviction of homeless encampments before the storm even hit, called for a series of phone zaps or call-in campaigns to pressure the city of Austin to extend services, demand hotels not evict those being housed, and also stop the eviction of encampments. In our next episode, we discuss what happened after the storm passed, and millions of Texans found themselves in a new reality. in the dark and without power. At the same time, organizers on the ground found the media spotlight focused directly on them as they rushed to provide direct aid in a moment of crisis. Moreover, other groups were busy organizing within this rupture, taking over parks and declaring cop-free zones, setting up makeshift encampments, organizing distribution hubs for aid, calling for protests against attacks on the homeless, and also working with tenants to launch rent strikes as many lost access to clean drinking water. Finally, if you enjoyed this episode and you want to support It's Going Down in our work, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation on our site or through Bitcoin. We need your help to continue into 2021. So if you value our work and you enjoyed this episode, please give us a donation. We'll see you soon.